My name is Brad Zimmerman. I'm an actor and a comedian who has worked with some great legends of comedy, such as Joan Rivers and George Carlin, to name a few. I will be doing my one-man show, My Son the Waiter, Jewish Tragedy, in New York City at Stage 72, the Triad Theater, October 10th through New Year's Eve, December 31st. Most of the show times are 7 p.m. at night. The matinees are 2, and the box office number is 212-868-4444. That's 212-868-4444. So I'm talking to Rabbi Sol Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Shalom, shalom, hello. Is this Brad Zimmerman?
Yes, so far, until further notice, yes, I'm Brad Zimmerman.
Well, until further notice, I am Rabbi Sol Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am very excited to be talking to not only a theater person, but a food person, someone who was a waiter for 3 decades and is now having a whole life-change career, trying his hand at stand-up comedy for the past bunch of years, having good success with it, opening for some incredibly major people, and he has a show called My Son the Waiter, a Jewish Tragedy, playing at the Triad Theater off-Broadway. Welcome to the neighborhood, Brad Zimmerman. Good Shabbos to you.
Good Shabbos to you, Rabbi. It's nice to know that you lack energy.
Thank you. Well, what can I tell you? It's a Shabbos. I get extra energy from Hashem on Shabbos. Let me ask you, how Jewish are you?
You mean on a scale of 1 to 10?
Well, you're from a chat to what the hell's the Hebrew number for 10?
I think the best way to put it is I'm proud to be a Jew, and I think we should put a period right after that. I'm not what you would call one of those synagogue goers necessarily, but...
Not even on the High Holies?
Excuse me?
Not even on the High Holies?
Well, that's between me.
Well, let me ask you, did you have a Jewish, strongly Jewish upbringing, conservative, reformed?
We belonged to a conservative temple. I was bar mitzvahed, and the day after my bar mitzvah, I went back out onto the ball field and continued my athletic career, which was a great athletic career as a youth, and it petered out in my high school days. I played a little college soccer.
Ooh.
I love being Jewish. I was born to be Jewish. I don't think I was born to be anything else.
Yes.
And, I mean, I don't think anybody could see me as a kind of a Episcopalian or something like
that. Oh, absolutely not. Or a Muslim. I just don't see it in the cards for you.
I was born to be a Jew. And the Jewish food, the energy, the chutzpah, the angst, the mothers, I was definitely born to be a Jew. Very proud to be a Jew. And I think that's important. And I think religion is all about just being a good person, generous, and having integrity. And I cover those bases entirely.
Well, let me ask you. I am curious. What would be your Hebrew name? Was it Bear or something with a book?
I have no idea. I can't even remember back that far.
Well.
Her name, I think, was Brad. Say it like, so Brad?
Brad Ben Brad. Something. So
that's my Hebrew name, Brad.
Now, let me, when you, when did you realize, and how did you shift your thinking when you realized that sports and athletics were not going to be your professional career? What did you do with that revelation?
That's a good question. The bottom line is I was, you know, everybody, I believe, has a purpose in life, and I believe we all have various gifts, and eventually, you know, we choose something if we're lucky enough that we love. I loved sports as a kid. I lived sports. I was consumed with it, and I was great. I was a great all-around athlete. But the interesting thing, Rabbi, is that never once in my life, during my childhood, did I ever think about, oh, I want to make this my life. There were kids who were 7, 8 who say to their fathers, I want to just play tennis, or I just want to be a baseball player. And I know people who are like that who made it to the pros. However, for me, it was just fun. So, I never practiced, and practice
was
perfect. So, as a matter of fact, so what happens is the talent is not enough to sustain you, and you see people who have less ability, who are better than you because they've practiced so hard. And I just went from one sport to another. I was so good at everything. I was told to just focus on baseball and I'd be a pro. I was told if I just played tennis, I would be great. All these things. Played soccer in college and it was my least favorite sport. So the reality is that for me, I never entertained notions. I had no idea.
But when you were in college then, what did you think you would be?
I had no idea, but I did take an aptitude test. This is all actually documented in the play. And it started me, it pointed me in the direction of the arts. So I actually went to a small school in Florida, which had a good athletic program for a Division III program and a very strong theater program.
Ooh.
I didn't entertain any notions of acting. I was in one play in my entire life in sixth grade.
What play? What was your character?
It was an original musical called Mr. Callender, and I played Mr. Callender.
Ooh, the lead.
Those were like January, February, March, April, whatever, you know, all that stuff.
I'll tell you one thing. It wasn't that great a play, but you got a lot of dates. I'm sorry.
Now, wait. That's brilliant.
Thank you.
Let me write that down.
Anyway. Okay.
Actually, for sixth grade, it turned out to be a wonderful musical. But that was the last of my acting. And then I took a course, and I had to audition for some plays as a result of this course. And I sort of realized that now, looking back on it, I didn't realize it then, what theater did for me was not that I loved acting, even though I played leads in lots of plays, was it made it possible for me not to sell furniture for my father.
Oh.
Last thing I wanted to do. I mean, both my brothers worked for my father. My father had a wonderful, successful business. He built it up from scratch. But I didn't want to do something institutional. I needed something, you know, I had needs for, you know, to be the center of attention like an athlete, to be, you know, to seeking approval and love and respect and all that stuff.
Like an athlete and a Jew, yes.
Yes, absolutely. So the reality is I went to New York and after 2 years of grad school and at Penn State University.
Well, grad school in what, theater?
I had a MFA, an assistantship, a scholarship in acting.
Ooh.
Where I was supposed to get my teacher's, MFA is it's like a PhD for an actor, and I could teach at colleges, but I realized after 2 years or a year and a half, I have no desire to teach, I'm just avoiding going to the city, so I quit after 2 years, went to the city, and then for the next 29 years waited tables, did not pursue my career because I really didn't feel the same kind of confidence in my acting that I felt at 9 years old as hitting a baseball. So basically my 20s, 30s, and even into my early 40s was really spent trying to get better at a craft.
Well, you're trying to get better at the craft of acting, but all the while you were a New York waiter.
Oh, of course, yes. There was nothing else for me to do, or if there was, I wasn't investigating it because I wasn't aggressive. I wasn't taking responsibility for... First of all, it was just me. There's no wife. There's no kids. My whole life has been, you know, devoted essentially to sort of getting my act together, which now I really have.
And you're taking it on the road, as it were. I mean, now you're in New York, but you've also played your act all over the country since the mid-1990s.
I started working on this one-man show, My Son, the Waiter at Jewish Tragedy, in 2005. And in 2013, it was deemed good enough by two producers. They bought the touring rights to the show. So I'm on a 7-year contract. I only have to do it for 3 years, and then they can find somebody else to play me.
Wow.
And I started a tour in Phoenix. I've been in Boston. I've been in San Diego. I've been in Maryland. I'm here in San Diego. I said Thousand Oaks. Monday I go home. It's the first time in like 5 months to New York, where I live, 20 blocks from the theater. And to say that will be one of the greatest days of my life is an understatement, because I am really homesick, and just to be back in that energy, that stimulation of New York, the fall, the Christmas, you know, it's going to be a wonderful day.
Now, the crux of your play, which is My Son the Waiter, excuse me, The Waiter, A Jewish Tragedy, and I assume a lot of it is taken up with the incredible, insane, awful things you've had to deal with customers for 29 years.
Well, Rabbi, here's the deal. The play does cover some of that, but the play is really a journey. One audience member who saw it the other night said, thank you, and it was a young kid, he said, thank you for taking us on your journey. And that's what I do, and some of it is being a waiter, of course, and there's a couple of, you know, there's some wonderful, wonderful bits that everybody relates to, whether you're Jewish or Gentile or whatever, but there's so much more to my life. Even though I waited tables, if I just did a show about waiting tables, it would be a comedy. In other words, it would just be stand-up comedy. This is a play.
Oh, okay.
It has very, very poignant moments. This is a very moving piece of theater, but it's also hysterical. And that's the most important thing, that it's exceptionally funny, but it's also very moving.
The moving parts have to do with your relationship with your dad?
No. It was the fact that my dad passed before he saw me have a certain amount of success. It has to do with just overcoming fear, and believing in myself, and developing this, finding my purpose in life, finding what I was born to do. And I know that now at age 60. And I'm not going to share this. I don't want to share it with you now simply because people need to come see
the show, of course.
But I think that the bottom line is that the show resonates for people like nothing else. It's so poignant and so, you know, Seth Godin, who's a wonderful motivational speaker and a brilliant man, said something very poignant recently. He said, we need art that is genuine, that connects, not fake, that entertains. And we have so much fake that entertains. Just turn on the television and watch a sitcom. There's nothing that resonates. My play resonates. Somebody Facebooked me the other day. She said, you're so authentic. She said, your authenticity is stunning.
Ooh.
What that means is, it's what Oscar Wilde said, be yourself, everyone else is taken. And that's what you see when you come to see.
Yes, but I can also quote the great Joe Franklin, who said that authenticity is the most important thing, and as soon as you learn to fake that, you've got it made. That's what I truly believe.
That's brilliant.
Yes, that's Joe. I don't know if he wrote that or if he's just quoting it, but that's the great
right.
Joe Franklin, ladies and gentlemen.
It's not funny enough to have written that. That sounds like something like Mark Twain or Woody Allen or... I mean, that's just brilliant.
Oh, good morning, H.L. Mencken kind of a thing. By the way, we're talking with Brad Zimmerman about his show, My Son the Waiter. Now, I did an off Broadway show of my own. It was called Shalom, Dammit. And I found one of the hardest things about writing this play, which mixed story and stand-up comedy, was what you leave out. So what are some of the things that were killers for you to cut from the play that you can tell us now?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, when you're working on a piece for 10 years, you have the most important thing is the writing in anything you do. Once you have the writing or the script, and the script is really fabulous, you're halfway home easily. In a process where you're taking stuff out on the road, and remember, this is a hybrid, part stand-up, part theater.
Okay.
So I'm always doing the stand-up part, so I'm always saying, okay, this doesn't work, this doesn't work. What's hard to take out is stuff that you like or love. I took out one of my favorite bit in the show, I took out.
What was it?
A couple of friends thought it was a little mean, and my character is not mean. He's real, but he's not mean. And I'm just a guy who tells it like it is. My persona is a guy who talks about stuff that he reacts to emotionally. So taking out, in other words, I might have taken out one mother piece because I had too much. I had enough mother stuff. In other words, I said what I needed to say in three little anecdotes. Rather, I didn't need four.
Sure. No, that's huge. You know,
and you throughout, and not only the important thing is also, I had a gentleman by the name of Murphy Davis who used to work in Sag Harbor at the Bay Street Theater. He was the artistic director who worked with me a little bit on editing. I've had some people help me edit. And they've taken out things that they thought might have been a little like massaging my ego too much. In other words, a little bit braggadocio that I didn't need.
Okay.
They were right. They were absolutely, they said, let the audience make that decision. You know, you don't have to tell them you're great. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
They were right. And even though I love the writing of some of the things, it's not easy because you see it on Broadway, you see it with all these playwrights who are so protective of every word. And with me, as much as my ego's enormous, I listen to anybody who says something where I go, you're right. As somebody who does it is not really a comedian because I don't do the clubs. I don't write jokes. I'm more of a storyteller. I don't think about punchlines.
Okay.
Stand up, you have to have like 5 punchlines a minute. Sometimes you got to wait 30 seconds or even over that for the payoff. But the payoff is a great payoff. And that, it's like watching, I'm closer to Cosby in that sense.
Storytelling, absolutely, okay.
Yes.
Although, you know, before you downgrade everything, I've got to say that there's clips of you on YouTube and clips of your show. And the clips that you have are really, really funny. It's one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on the program.
That is why, that's the stand-up part of the show. In other words, that was written years ago when I was thinking more in terms of maybe getting to the punchline, but I've evolved my process, never worrying about the punchline, knowing that what's really, really, really funny is truth. And I think that's what's missing, frankly, is that when you watch these shows on television, there's the pressure to get to the punchline, so it's almost as if you know it's coming, and you know, oh, that's where we're supposed to laugh. Now, with what I do, people have told me, we never know when it's going to, your punchlines are coming. Because the truth of what I say has people laughing.
But let me ask you a question then. In this form, as a play, you can do that. You can mix between theater and even drama, poignancy, and comedy. But you were doing the stand-up thing. You've opened for people like Joan Rivers and George Carlin and who else? There was Brad Garrett. I didn't even know he did stand-up. So how do you condense the kind of thing that you do to 10, or I don't know how long an opener does, but 10, 15 minutes?
Well, with Joan and Brad and George, I was doing 30 minutes.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, it was great. It was great working with all of them. What I do is, first of all, it's a hybrid. Now, a typical one-person show, the ones where, let's say you went to a teacher who taught one-person shows, the basic premise is that you have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you have to have what is called an arc, which means that it goes up, and then, you know, it sort of comes down with it, it winds down. Now, mine is different. And it goes against the grain of stand-ups in that there is an arc, but maybe it's not huge, but it doesn't bother me because the play works. That's the important thing. So I've gone outside the box. So what I've done, weaved it so that a lot of the beginning, I set up the situation, the circumstances, my childhood, you know, talking then about waiting tables and then from there into a lot of different anecdotes about the world as I see it and all sorts of things that I miss, let's say, about my childhood and comparing it. And then I get that, then the play aspect starts a bit, or for lack of a better word.
Sure.
You know, my social life, my mother, my father, finally being sent to a therapist who helped me enormously going into the world. I took a comedy class in 96.
Okay.
That was the pivotal moment in my life, because if I had not taken a stand-up comedy class, who knows what would have happened to me.
Now, let me ask you, said the one thing that you had to conquer was, to paraphrase Roosevelt, fear itself. Did you have terrible, what do they call that, stage fright? Did you have to get over that, or that wasn't an issue?
It wasn't stage fright. It was a lack of belief. Remember, if I sell shoes, I don't have to believe in the shoes to sell them. If I'm selling me as an actor, acting is a craft. And I never felt like I was in possession of the craft like I did as an athlete. I was just born with the ability to hit a baseball. I could, you know, make adjustments. But as an actor, what I didn't know that I know now is that the only way to learn or really to get that craft is to go out into the world and fail. And when I went out into the world as a comedian, finally, I mean, my first gig in the Catskills was an Orthodox Hungarian Jewish bungalow. And let me tell you something, Rabbi.
Yes?
First of all, I drove up there, and the Catskills is all Orthodox now, or most of it, and I don't even want to finish talking about that because I'll get a little upset. The reality is that I was supposed to do 55 minutes, and I bailed, which means I didn't do 55, I did 15. And it's funny because 15 minutes I did, I was a rookie. So I failed, I didn't get paid. But the good thing is the booking agency booked me the next week. They just said, well, we booked you too soon at a tough stoic, you know, group of people who look at you like you're chalk. Okay?
Right.
So the reality is that it's experiences like that that have made me a warrior in the sense that there's nothing that is going to stop me from doing what I need to do. It's tough when there's no give and take between an audience.
Sure.
Sometimes I do my show in demographics that are outside my comfort zone. In other words, these are not the most... We don't have what I would call a sophisticated country. There are pockets of sophistication. But this is a sophisticated piece. This is not spoon-feeding people punchlines. This is going to make people think. And there are a lot of people who don't think. They live a life on sort of autopilot.
We call those Republicans, yes.
They live their whole life without thinking about their life, about, like, I live a self-examining life. In other words, am I happy? What should I be doing that will make me happy? What do I need? A sort of a solitary existence, but not a lonely existence. I've come so far in my journey that it's pretty amazing what I think I've done, to be very honest with you. Quite amazing. I'm enormously proud of myself, and I'm lucky to have a really solid base of friends and family.
Was it a conscious choice not to have a life partner, let alone kids or pets?
The bottom line is when you are put in a position where you're very depressed, you feel like you're not pursuing a career, you're watching people with less ability go out and pursue their career, and you eventually, you know, get bitter and just very depressed and to the point where you're just, you know, you don't want to leave your apartment. The last thing on your mind is a partner. So the reality is that I love women, and at some point I will meet someone. There's no question in my mind. There are absolutely none. I mean, I've gone on dates now, but I haven't met anybody who's right for me.
Okay.
But the reality is, as somebody said in the business who's very successful, this is Brad's time. In other words, right now everything is popping for me. There's a lot of interest in me. And, you know, I love children. Like, people, when I would wait tables, they would say to me, how come you don't have kids? And I'll be honest with you, Rabbi, I love children more than adults, but the fact that I don't have kids, I'm incredibly lucky. I am so lucky because I am able to do my work. It would be selfish. I'm just warming up at 60. Most of my friends are grandparents, and they're showing pictures of their grandchildren on Facebook, and I'm thinking, oh, thank God I don't have to do this.
Exactly. Well, let me ask you, Brad Zimmerman, you have been...
By the way, Brad Zimmerman is one word. You do know that.
Brad Zimmerman. Yeah, I'm trying to say it as fast as possible. Brad Zimmerman. I mean, I'm leaving even out the D, so it's Brad Zimmerman, like that.
Are you going to come see my show?
I'm hoping to, because I will be in New York at that time. When it's first happening.
Where are you? Where are you now?
Right. Well, I'm currently taping here at the University of Northern Colorado. I do a bunch of these, and I go back to my temple.
Wow, I had no idea.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dave...
That was my safety school.
What?
I'm only kidding.
Oh, I'm but let me ask you, first of all, when was the last time you waited in that sense?
Yeah, that's another great question. You know what's interesting is that when I was 58 and I had nothing going because I had no money, I didn't know the value of saving and all of this stuff, I said to my therapist, 2 more years. I had no money. I said, till when I'm 60, I'm out. I said, I'm gone. I'm done. Whatever I have to do to make a living, I'll do it, but I'm done pursuing any kind of theater career.
Okay.
He said, he said, keep the faith. That's all he said. He didn't, you know, don't get out. He just said, keep the faith. So the reality is that in 2012, and so I guess I was 58, I had to actually, you know, suck it up and go back and wait tables for a little bit of time. I thought it would be longer than that just to, you know, help pay some bills because I had no money, none at all.
Well, you're living in New York. I don't even know how even being a waiter you could support yourself in Manhattan.
You know, you can support yourself. That's a generalization. I mean, there are waiters who work at places they make $300 a night. On the other hand, it is very difficult to live in New York, to find a place where the rent is affordable. If you're poor, you can live in New York, or if you're rich, it's that kind of thing. Now the middle class seems to be having a tough time. I've lived in the same one-room apartment for 33 years, so I'm rent-stabilized. So my apartment is in an ideal place. It's the hottest area in the city, the Upper West Side.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm the luckiest man on the face of the earth. My rent is cheap, but what happened was, that's in early 2013, I met a manager. He saw the YouTube, and he thought, this guy... they should be in the theater. So he got me 3 weeks at a small theater in Florida called Stage Door. That 3 week run turned into a 4 month run because of demand and a word of mouth. The owner of the theater knew the two producers who produce Steve Solomon's show, My Mother's Italian, My Father's Jewish, I'm in Therapy.
Yes.
They also produce Old Jews Telling Jokes. There's so many titles with Jew in the show.
I know, right?
My original title did not have Jew in the show. The original title of my play was Attaboy Zimmy, which is how my father used to cheer me when I was an athlete. But when the first theater that actually said, we will do this, was in Florida, it was a great theater in West Palm Beach, the Kravis Center for the Performing Arts. They put me in the small theater, and the creative director said to me, are you attached to the title? I said, no. He said, put Jewish in the title. It's a great selling point, especially in Florida.
Just having an off-Broadway show for 2.5 months, week after week, the audience has come, you get the press, you get the...
I'm from my house, Rabbi, 20 blocks. And the other thing is, and here's the real important thing, these producers believe in the show so much that they want to move it to Broadway, to a small Broadway theater. And I believe that that will happen. But if it doesn't, I'm already scheduled to work the Huntington Library Theater in Huntington Beach, California, from there to Rhode Island.
What theater's in Rhode Island? I'm trying to think.
Trinity Rep.
Oh, Trinity, of course.
Very, very famous story theater. We rented the space. What we do is we look for theaters around the country in areas that are conducive to me doing the show or their other products. They also own a theater in Philadelphia called, I forget what it's called, but it's right on the waterfront.
Oh, nice.
And in Philly, and I'll be doing that theater. One of the producers was just in England, and England would be, I'd kill in England, because there's loads of Jews.
Yes.
A lot of English people have come see the show and just loved it. So this is, I mean, people from all over the world have come to see the show and loved it. And again, it's not just a Jewish show, it's just a show for people who don't mind using their brains. So there you have it.
Well, there you have Brad Zimmerman. Remember, the name of the show is My Son the Waiter, a Jewish Tragedy. It'll be playing at the Triad Theater. That's up on West 72nd Street, and it's running. Don't wait until December to catch it, but you do have until the end of the year, until New Year's, to catch it.
Absolutely.
before I let you go, Brad Zimmerman, see, I'm saying it really quickly now. In working with, I'm always curious about other comics and other celebrities. So you work, or you open for, I should say, George Carlin, one of my heroes. Any thoughts on what he was like? Did you get to talk with him?
George was a wonderful man, extremely supportive of me, of all comics, especially the ones he liked. He was a very private man. He was a brilliant man, extremely well-read. In fact, a very quick story.
Sure.
About a month or 2 months right before his last HBO special. In fact, when I started working with him, he was working on that special. And he would actually bring sheets of paper out on the stage, his notes.
Sure.
So his manager approached me and he said, I have a deal. Supposing I have HBO, the night before the live taping of George's show, film you during dress rehearsal, doing 30 minutes, and we have 90 days once we get the tape to market it. Now, I did phenomenal. I killed. I got like 10 applause breaks. And nothing worked out because the manager took it to one high-powered agent, which was ridiculous, because the high-powered agent handles comics who make $100,000 a night.
Right.
You know, so they had, you know, he doesn't want to do the work to try to market me. So that didn't work out, but that's how highly they thought of me. So George was great. He was one of the smartest comics. You know, what he did was so great was he made an adjustment. You know, he started out a little bit, not corny, but, you know, the hippy-dippy weatherman and all that stuff. That's still real smart. But he evolved into more of a ranter and with a little bit more of an edge. 14 or 15 HBO specials, nobody's ever done that.
Well, he was great. He was, it wasn't even that he started out just the hippy-dippy. Then he became a kind of a hippie, went through the drug thing, and then in later years he really became the ranter and sort of the angry old man, which wasn't always his best stuff, but still there were moments.
Absolutely.
When he was great all the way.
Absolutely.
Now let me ask, of course we have to talk about the other person who left us a couple of weeks ago, Joan Rivers. Was she a friend or just a very supportive colleague?
No, I was friendly with her. I'd been to her house to break the Yom Kippur, you know, to break the fast.
Oh, my.
Her mansion. I was invited to the funeral, the memorial, and to the Shiva at Melissa's, but I couldn't make either because I'm out here.
Okay.
We were friendly, and she loved me, and she thought I was great. And she was really a believer in me. But, you know, Joan was so busy with so many different things that, you know, when you get to the theater where she's performing, you don't have a lot of time to schmooze. You know, that's why I've always maintained that as much as it's an honor to work with these people, my favorite thing is always working with my peers, you know, and that I love. That there's nothing like that in the world. No matter which, the thing about opening for a celebrity, Rabbi, is you got to do great the first time, then they want to use you. The first time I opened for Brad Garrett, I just killed. And I knew that I'd be working for him for a couple of years. So that's the way it went. And the same with Joan. Joan loved me, and her people loved me. And and the sad thing is she died at 81, and she was on top of her game. I mean, she was still going out there and, you know, like a professional middleweight and, you know, jabbing away. She was incredible.
Well, she rebuilt. Well, she never had to rebuild her career. She never went away. But she would take the last few years and do these little clubs in the village, like, what was it, 88s or Don't Tell Mama.
What are you talking about? No, these are the when she does
the duplex.
These little theaters on a Wednesday night, that's to practice her new material.
Right, yes.
Oh, absolutely. But that, and she would donate all the money to her favorite charity, which was, I think, the homeless, or I think that it was the homeless, all the money that came in.
She was actually buying the homeless plastic surgery, which I thought was really nice of her. I'm kidding, of course. And by the way, I mean, in the sense of there's no such thing as bad publicity as long as there's publicity. You found yourself, of all things, on the pages of the Post and the Daily News. Not, unfortunately, for your show, but somebody played a prank on you?
No, this was orchestrated. I'm not going to go into it deeply. All you need to know is that I had nothing to do with it. I would never in a million years, if I had known about it, and it, if somebody had said to me, you know, 3 days after this legend or anybody dies, and they have this radio say, that voice going, go see Brad's show, you know, I have so much integrity. I'm about making it on my talent, not on, you know, this kind of, this, you
well,
know.
Well, no, she really done,
to tell the truth. And what disappoints me a little bit is that, you know, none of Joan's assistants have reached out because, you know, for whatever reason, but, you know, I have nothing to do with anything. You know, I'm just, and all my friends and anybody who knows me knows that, you know, this was concocted by somebody, and I'm not going to go any further because that's none of your business. And just to let you know that I had nothing to do with it.
But I'm not saying that you did. I'm saying either somebody played a prank on you, or you assumed that it really was a recording of Joan Rivers, and boy, oh boy, how wonderful.
It wasn't Joan Rivers. It was not her name. It was not her voice. It was, if you read up on it, it's all documented, but I'm not going to talk about
it. Okay.
You can read up on it and find out who is behind it, and that, and who even whose voice it was. And
I didn't know that all that was already out there. All I know is that I'm Dave, especially, and I are good friends with Beck Lee, who is the publicist for your show, and he's also, you know, been taking a lot of heat. And I don't, it would not be him. He's a great guy. He would not pull something like this.
Well,
so.
You call Beck, and he'll tell you what he wants to tell you. That, because that's all I'm saying on the subject.
Ooh.
That I had nothing to do with it, but it was orchestrated and it was in poor taste. And that's all I'm going to tell you.
That's fair. That's fair. Now, the last question for Brad Zimmerman. Tell us one thing, and it doesn't have to be something from your show, but since you had to cut and cut to shape the material, we do want to hear something funny, a funny, awful story of your being a waiter and having to deal with someone in a restaurant.
Oh boy. I guess, you know, it's it would probably be the woman, you know, who takes forever, you know, to order. So it would be like, everything looks so good. And you say you're out of the swordfish. Well, I had chicken for lunch. I don't want heavy. This looks good, but I can't have peppers. I mean, I can, but I shouldn't. What are you getting? No. Okay. All right. Okay. I'll tell you what. I'll take... Give me... Let me have... Between the duck and the lamb, which would you get? Huh? Not the lamb? There you go, Rabbi.
Oh, my God. That's one of the clips I saw on YouTube, and it just, oh. You're telling me that didn't kill with the Orthodox Hungarians? Oh, my God.
Let me tell you something. What I've learned in this world, Rabbi, and then I got to go,
sure,
is that there are people, a lot of people, and comedians are the best people to gauge this in the world, who don't laugh. It doesn't matter how funny it is, and I'm surprised that you wouldn't know this, that you look out and you see faces that are just, they don't enjoy life.
Mm.
They don't, life to them is... It's just, it's not meant to be, for whatever reason, I see faces that are so alive with receptivity, and then I see faces where, what Thoreau said, they're, you know, living lives with quiet desperation, and they don't want to die, but they're waiting to die. And there's a whole lot of people in the world, because they don't have purpose, or their childhood was such that they, laughing was frowned upon. I've been in areas where people were like, laughter was... Like in San Diego, it was like somebody would start laughing and then cover their mouth because it's, oh, this is inappropriate. I said to her, I said, well, what did you just do that for? Why don't you let, what are you doing? And I actually confronted her and she stopped doing it. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. So, and what I did was, there are people who don't get that. They don't understand that, what I just did for you. They just, they don't relate to it, or they want Rodney Dangerfield. So I went up to them, I don't get any respect, bump. I don't get any respect, bump. I don't get any respect, bump. They can't take the silence. They're uncomfortable. They need to do stuff where their mind doesn't have to do any work.
Or they need a laugh track even. Just someone to tell them it's okay to watch other people laughing.
Yeah. All right, I gotta go.
Well, it's been a delight talking to Braz Zimmerman. Go see him in My Son the Waiter, a Jewish tragedy at the Triad Theater, 158 West 72nd Street. Brad, congratulations on your growing success, and shalom to you.
Thank you. Good Shabbos, Rabbi. Great talking to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.